Welcome, everybody. Service, please. Welcome to Overeaters Anonymous 50th birthday party. My name is Diana, and I'm a compulsive overeater. Will everyone who cares to please join me in the serenity prayer? God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. The title of this panel is Pain Hurts, But Recovery Heals. All of the panel topics this weekend are taken from For Today, the Daily Reader, first published by Overeaters Anonymous in 1982. This panel's topic comes from the July 20th reading. You have that on the yellow sheet in front of you, and we will now read it. Nature is no spendthrift, but takes the shortest way to her ends. Ralph Waldo Emerson. Growth is the phenomenon of nature. I cannot push it, shape it, make it happen. I can only do the footwork, endure the pain, and know that the results are not up to me. There is struggle in the growth process, misused will stand in the way and must be overcome gradually with understanding and compassion. Pain is always the teacher, but with each period of growth, it becomes less acute. Growth is the opposite of control. Another term for it is learning to let go and let God. And that is a subject I can only expect to get better at, not master. For today, do I really need to be in control, which is wasted motion, really? Or can I trust in my higher power? I will let today be a wonderful surprise. We have three speakers on this panel. As they are sharing, we will pass around the Ask It basket. Please be sure to continue to keep it moving, even if you have already passed it. As the speakers continue to share, members may think of questions that they did not have when the basket first passed by. So right now we have Wilma and Janine who will get the baskets going. Just so you have yourselves ready, after the second speaker, that's about a half an hour from now, I'm going to have the baskets passed forward so you know what kind of a time frame you're working from. Okay? All right. So at this point, would you please all help me welcome our first speaker? Her name is Nancy, who will share her experience, strength, and hope for the next 15 minutes. Thank you.
Hi, everybody. My name is Nancy, Nancy D.
Hi, Nancy.
And I say that because OA is filled with Nancys. I've had the experience of being in a four Nancy meeting. Let me see the hands of everybody who's nervous. So, growth is a phenomenon of nature. I can only do the footwork, endure the pain, and know that the results are not up to me. Well, that's also another word for life. That's like life spelled out in long terms. So one of the biggest challenges I've had, one of the most painful challenges, which is kind of a challenge talking about pain, but there it is. One of my most painful, challenging times was the time in program some years back when I had a brain aneurysm. And a brain aneurysm is a unscheduled bleed in the brain. It's not a good thing. The statistics were bad, very bad. They told my family that there was an 80% chance that I would not live, and that if I lived, there was a 20% likelihood that I would be a vegetable. Stats were bad. So, but I don't know any of this because I'm in a coma. So, when it struck, I was talking with a friend across a dining room table, and it seemed to me that we began to separate from one another, that I was becoming distant from her. I hadn't moved, she hadn't moved, but that's what it initially felt like. The pain was extraordinary, what I imagine it feels like to be shot in the head, what I imagine it feels like. So, that's how it gets started. I'm so nervous. Gosh, I hope I remember to tell the story. The just one couple more medical details about it. When it happened, the medical technician approached me. I'm unconscious. The medical technician approached me. I woke up for a second, and he asked, what seems to be the trouble? And I said two words, cerebral hemorrhage. That was the first gift. How did I know it was a cerebral hemorrhage? But that was given to me. Okay, so they take me to the hospital. I'm in a coma. I'm in a coma for a long time. 21 days later, I wake up. And I wake up, and I don't know that I've been in a coma. And what I awakened to was the telephone ringing. And I could hear that it was on my left side. I answered it. Perfect. Perfect. The synchronicity of that, right? I answer it. It's a voice that I know who said hi to me, and it was a sponsee. And someone I sponsor in this fellowship. And so they had to tell me where I was, why I was there, what had happened, blah, 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 blah. When you come out of a coma, you don't just wake up. That's not how it happens. It happens in flashes. You're awake for a moment. Sometime later, you're awake for another moment. You're awake for another moment. You're not just awake and then the lights are on. It doesn't happen like that. Anyway, fast forward. Okay. I had brain surgery. I have a metal clip in my head, and no, it does not set off the metal detector. But now I have to come back to life. And I don't know that I don't know how to do things. Like I had to learn how to walk again. I had to learn how to talk again. I had to learn how to write again. I didn't know how to write until I tried to write. And I understood what writing was. I remembered a pen, and I understood that I had a checkbook. But when I went to write it, I didn't know how to do it. But I didn't know how to know. Okay. It was tough. Take it from me, it was tough. And so I'm in a 12-step program. And I'm accustomed to, when I'm having a challenging time, I want to talk with others. That's what I got that from here. I want to talk with others. So how many people have experience with a brain aneurysm? Let me see the hands. Oh, hello. We'll talk later. But there aren't a lot of people with experience with that, and I had to learn a lot of things. Like, I had to learn. People would want to help. They'd say, how are you doing? Can I help you? And I knew that I needed help, but my speech wasn't such that I could respond. Or I knew I needed help, but I couldn't think of how to put the sentence together to tell you. Or I knew I needed help, but somebody had helped me earlier in the day, and I didn't want to ask somebody to help again. Or it was just hard. It was just hard, you know, in a few words. Okay, so I get home from the hospital, and there's a hospital bed in my living room where my sofa had been, because I lived in a two-story, and I wasn't supposed to climb the stairs. But I'd been in the hospital for 30 days. I wanted to be in my own bed. And so I crawled upstairs on my hands and knees up the stairs, but then I didn't know what to do. I was just overwhelmed. I was home. I didn't know what to do. I wanted to get home. I'm home now. What do I do? What did I think of? You know what I thought of? One day at a time. Because I didn't know what to do. And when that thought, without program, I wouldn't have had that thought. I didn't have a clue what to do. But I knew that I didn't have to figure out anything beyond one day. And one day was smaller. I just crawled up the stairs. I was trying to get in bed. Oh, put on pajamas. That solved it for me because I was just overwhelmed. But I could put on pajamas. So I put on the pajamas and I got in bed. And then the next day I didn't know what to do, and I remembered that I didn't have to figure it out. I just had to do it one day at a time, and it kept it really small. And even though I still didn't know what to do, it was on a smaller scale and was more hopeful. Okay. So I start coming back to meetings, and, you know, everything's different in my life. It just affected everything. And I wanted to come back to meetings, and my neurosurgeon was asking me, why are you bugging me so much to let you drive again? Because they take away your driving privileges when you have a brain aneurysm. You're not cleared to drive. But I wanted to drive again. Why are you so anxious to drive again? Why are you so anxious to drive again? I said, because I'm in a 12-step program and I want to go to meetings. And he was like, okay, if you promise me you will only drive to meetings, I'll give you, it's okay for you to drive. And I did that. And I, you don't think about it. We don't have to think about it daily anymore. But when you think about what you have to do simultaneously, look forward, monitor the mirrors, look at the back mirror, hands on the wheel, feet on the pedal, going where you want to simultaneously, it's a lot. And it was way over what I could do easily. But I did go to meetings, and I guess what I talked about when I got to the meetings? Having had a brain aneurysm. And the next day when I went to a meeting, guess what I talked about? Brain aneurysm. Next day, what do you think I talked about? Brain aneurysm. Thank you. Next week, what did I talk about? Brain aneurysm. Next week, brain aneurysm. Okay. So that became hard for me. And I imagine it might have become hard for you, those of you that were in the room with me at the time, because that's all, some aspect of it, Nancy B's like they're going, yeah. Some aspect of it affected every waking and sleeping moment of my life. It affected everything. Okay, I'm talking about brain aneurysm every day, every week, home meetings, so the same people are hearing me talk about it. And that began to be a problem for me because now I'm worried about what do you think about me because all I can talk about is a brain aneurysm. And that was a problem. Now I'm talking about my sponsor about the fact that all I could talk about is the fact that I had a brain aneurysm. So what do I do about that? And this is what I learned, and I learned it here. What I learned is there was a woman, she and I had the same home meeting. It was Wednesday night, Palms Pavilion. We went to that same home meeting, and her ex-husband had been murdered. And guess what she talked about every week? Her ex-husband had been murdered. And she talked about that every week. Did I say she talked about it every week? Because she talked about it every. And she was one of the ones in the meeting who always raised her hand to share. And guess what she talked about? Her husband, ex-husband, had been murdered. Every week she talked about that. Every week she talked about that. And over time, I began to roll my eyes, only virtually. I didn't actually do it, but I felt it inside. Here she talk. What's she going to talk about? Every week she's going to talk about her husband. Okay. But this is what happened. What happened was she'd given me a gift all those years. And she talked about him and that what happened with the death of her ex-husband for 2.5 years. And I don't remember any longer how I know that it was 2.5 years, but I do know that. That every week, home meeting, 2.5 years, she's talking about ex-husband murder. But she taught me that it was okay to talk about what you needed to talk about as long as you needed to talk about it, even if it's all you talked about every week ad infinitum. And she gave me that gift. And so when all I could talk about was, altogether, brain aneurysm, it was okay to do so. And so she gave me a gift, and I didn't know she was giving me a gift. She didn't know she was giving me a gift. And this little addendum to that is I saw her after the brain aneurysm at a birthday party, hello, some years after that, and I was able to tell her she'd given me that gift and thank her. She didn't know she was giving me a gift, and I didn't either, because remember, what was I doing? I was rolling my eyes, if only virtually. But she'd given me the gift. I learned that it was okay, that it wasn't necessary. In fact, it was a big part of my healing process to know that it was okay to talk about it as long as I had to. I learned, too, that when I was healing from that, and you don't get over that right away. It doesn't happen in a week or two or three or four or 32. It takes a long time to recover. And it's in little increments, and it doesn't look like you think it should look. It doesn't look like you think it should look. It looks like how it does. And when I would be home all day, I wasn't able to watch TV at first because it went too fast for me. I couldn't understand it. And it seemed mean. And that the sitcoms and the things were, they weren't kind to each other, and I didn't understand it, so I didn't watch TV. So I was home all day, and I started to feel guilty at the place I go, because I thought I wasn't doing anything. And what someone who knew more than me shared with me was, yes, I was doing something 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, whether I was aware of it or not, is I was healing. I had a tremendous injury. And 24 hours a day, my body and its injury, its energies were healing. So when I didn't think I was doing something all day, every day, somebody would say, what have you been doing today? I'd say, well, I've been healing, and I've been, and it was true. So I learned the perspective of that, that I thought that, oh, now that I'm thinking about all that I've learned through this, another thing I learned was about resting. I thought that resting kind of meant I wasn't doing anything, and I learned that when I did too much trying to heal, that I got depleted and it set me back, and resting became, I literally came to put it on my calendar as if it were a meeting at 2 o'clock or a luncheon at 3. I had rest. And I learned that's a valid thing. I somehow minimized it as if it weren't important if it was called rest, and I learned that that's not true. The spiritual experience behind, oh, thank you, gosh, I was so concerned I wouldn't fill up the time. What was I thinking? Just a couple more things about it not being in my control. The spiritual experience connected with having, with almost leaving the world was the most profound thing that's ever happened to me. And that became a little bit of a challenge because all I wanted to do was be in the meditative contemplative place that I found myself filled with the spirituality, with dishes to do and with errands to run, but all I wanted to do was, you know, be about peace and love all day, literally. I had to learn how to come back to the practical, to the daily life, and to rejoin the living. And if you ever had, I don't know if you could relate to me talking about that, but it was a difficult thing for me to learn to come back into today. And program was helpful with me about that because I was talking about it again and about, I just couldn't figure out, I had to make the choice to be here and alive. And not, I was mourning the loss of the profound spiritual connection. So that was challenging for me. But without program, without that start, without the understanding that I didn't have to have it all figured out, that I just had to do it one day at a time, I just would have been lost and overwhelmed by the whole thing. And because of program and because of my connection with God, it didn't turn out that way. The doctors were wrong. I didn't end up a vegetable. I didn't, you know, I lived. And it didn't look like it was going to be a bright, shiny picture in the end, but it turned out okay. And bright and shiny doesn't mean it's going to be a bad thing. Not bright and shiny. Just because the ending of the story isn't bright and shiny doesn't mean it's necessarily a bad thing. So I've learned a lot through it. I wouldn't change anything about it. And thank you. Thank you for listening to my share.
Okay, would everyone please help me welcome Corey to share her experience, strength, and hope.
Hello, I'm Corey. I'm a compulsive eater.
Hi,
Corey. Hi. Well, it's nice to be here. A couple things. Karen asked me yesterday to fill in on the panel, and I'm so grateful because I would have been obsessing for months. and I'm sure nobody can relate to that. I am a compulsive overeater. I took a candle in December for 18 years of abstinence, and thank you. And I've been in program for, I think, almost 22 years, and that's pretty exciting. And a couple of people this weekend have said to me that they have a hard time picturing me as an adult because I came in when I was in my 20s and just a kid. But I wrote down some notes before just because I knew I was going to be nervous and probably rambling and then run out of time and go, oh, I just need another minute. So when Karen asked me, she said that she was thinking about me on this panel because many years ago while I was in program I had open heart surgery, and when I don't know how much of that story to tell because I want to talk about the recovery from it, but apparently I was born with a hole in my heart due to a lot of things, including a lot of neglect as a kid and bad medical care and lots of things. It was missed. And so when I was in my 20s and I got a job and I got my own benefits for the first time, and I went to the dentist, and the dentist said, have you ever had a heart murmur? And I said, yes, and checked the box, and they said, okay, you need to go to your doctor. And the doctor said, well, we hear a little something. We'll send you to the cardiologist. Maybe it's nothing. And I went to the cardiologist, and they said, well, we hear a little something. Maybe it's nothing. We'll send you to the cardiothoracic surgeon. And within a year, I was having open-heart surgery. And I love that I got to share after the previous speaker, because I did learn so much from that speaker's experience, because it was just on the tail end of her coming out of that I went into this surgery. And it wasn't unplanned. I knew it was coming, but I didn't have a whole lot of experience. I had been in program for a while. I didn't have a whole lot of experience really letting anybody in, and letting anybody in particularly to help me, and how to find, you know, there's a continuum of like being needy and like being self-sufficient, and we're all somewhere on there. And I just had very little objectivity about where I was on there, and I was worried about being on the needy side, so I spent a lot of time hanging out at the self-sufficient side. And when I couldn't drive for 6 weeks after my surgery, because they broke up in my chest, whatever, and my rib cage, and all those muscles were healing, and they need them to heal properly. So I still have metal, and I don't go off in the metal detectors either. But I have, like, if you look at the x-rays, I have like a spiral notebook around my rib cage, which is really cool. But I coming out of that, I remember so clearly, I was in the hospital for a week, and so much change happened for me in the hospital that week. I woke up, the deal with open heart surgery is you come out of it, but they don't reverse the anesthesia. So for about 24 hours, I was in ICU, and then they put me into a normal room, and I got to eat something, all of a sudden, four women from my home meeting, or maybe it was five, I don't remember how many, but from my home meeting came, and we had a meeting that day. And I don't even remember particularly all of what I shared, but I remember sharing that it was really hard for me to let people in. A friend of mine had given me some suggestions before I was scheduled for my surgery, and what she said was, why don't you make a schedule and invite people to fill in places on the schedule, maybe who's going to bring you meals at certain times and who's going to be able to do different things. And it was so hard for me. And I did some of it, and I just had a really hard time asking for help. It's still something that's hard for me, but it's no longer prohibitive for me. But I had a really hard time. And I remember my sponsor at the time, when I came out of the hospital, wanted to bring me lunch, and I was telling a friend earlier about this story, that she wanted to bring me lunch, and she said, where would you like me to get lunch? And my response, which was typically my response, which was really appropriate coming from, you know, the family that I came from, where I got that no one was going to meet my needs, and I finally got that I was just going to stop asking because it was easier. But now I'm in a place where I'm in a program, and I had people that really wanted to be of service. Like the great thing about some of the tenets of our program is that we really get that we can't keep it unless we give it away. And so being of service, you know, I love to be of service because it's just a part of who I am, but also it helps my recovery. So there's a very selfish motive in being of service as well. So my sponsor said, where would you like me to get you lunch? And I said, oh, wherever's convenient, you know. And I'm very picky. I mean, if it has sugar, I'll eat whatever it is, you know. But I'm very picky about where I like to eat and what I like to eat. And if you ever go out to eat with me, you'll know, okay, I'd like this salad without the cheese. And, you know, is there nuts in that? Okay, no nuts, but, you know, add the corn, but no beans. And I'm just that way. And so, but I was willing, because someone was going to bring me lunch, to say, whatever's convenient for you. And she taught me, my sponsor said, no, I want to bring you food that you're going to like. And, that was a major lesson. If that had been a movie, that would have been like plot point number one, you know, that people want to be of service. And it's probably more service if they get to bring me what I want than if I made her choose and she'd have to drive all over town figuring out what I wanted. But I didn't perceive it that way at the time. I just didn't want to be a burden. And that was a big part of my story pre-recovery. And then in recovery, one of the things that I've really had to battle with. And now, you know, my partner and I live together, and there's a lot of, like, you know, I do things. She's doing my laundry today, by the way, which is wonderful and huge for me to let her do that. Thank you. But she doesn't fold it. She just takes it out of the dryer and puts it back in the basket. And that's if I'm going to have her do my laundry, like that's, you know, I just have to accept that that's the way it's going to be because I fold it when it comes out of the dryer so it doesn't get wrinkled. But so I've got to contend with, like, you know, accepting people where they are. I don't know how laundry has to do with heart surgery, but one of the things that I remember really clearly, I remember I used to go to the Sunday morning meeting, the Marina Center meeting, and I went there one day when I was in this process. I wasn't yet back at work. I was off work for 6 weeks. And I just remember sharing, I don't know where I want to be, but I don't want to be here. And I, that was the truth. And I just shared it, and I someone else came up afterwards and didn't say, don't feel that way, or what do you mean you don't want to be here? Here is where you are. What they said was, I really can relate, because I don't want to be here either. And I didn't mean here like I wanted to kill myself. I just meant like in that place in my recovery. I didn't want to be in that place anymore. I wanted to be over here. And for the front row, over here. And I remember also my sponsor at the time saying, I said, you know, I just wanted to get better. And she said, well, it's already getting better. You just can't see it because it's slow and you keep on checking it every 2 seconds. And every time you take your own temperature about where you are, you don't really get to give it a chance and let yourself heal. So I love the in the reading the concept that that control and surrender are polar opposite, and I didn't know that. I really thought that I just have to control it so I can get better, you know, and I got to learn that. I mean, I think things get better anyway even when we control them, but it was hard, and I learned that's really coming out of my heart surgery is really when I found a power greater than myself that really worked for me. And I had many years of seeking. As a kid, I think I was always seeking. I just didn't know I was seeking, but I just always tried to make humans my higher power. And someone earlier said, in a panel earlier, said something about finding someone to be their mother. And I was just always looking for someone who can rescue me. And coming out of my heart surgery, there was something really profound about that experience that I found God. And I think part of it was that day that those women from my home meeting came to have a meeting in my room when I was, you know, 2 days out of surgery. And for the first time, I realized that I can be invited to a gathering that I don't plan. You know, maybe that happens for some people, but I planned so much in my life so I would be included. And all of a sudden, I had all this love come into my room. And I didn't have to plan it. And they were there, and they brought literature. They, like, lugged literature down to Good Samaritan Hospital downtown. And they had just a really beautiful women's stag in my hospital room that day. Someone said, I heard in a meeting recently, and most of what I say, you know, if it's brilliant, I stole it from someone else, because, like, we have brilliance here, we just recycle it, and except when we wash and dry it, we fold it before we put it in the basket. hi, honey. I forget where I was going with that. So this is someone said, and it's so, in a lot of ways, characterized my experience coming out of heart surgery. But I remember saying back then that I just wanted to get so spiritual that I could transcend the human condition of pain. And someone in a meeting recently said, no matter how much I do, I never rise above being a human being. And I think what I got in my heart surgery is that life is going to include pain. Like, I didn't think that before. I had so much pain, and I guess I just thought that just wasn't God's will, all the pain, or maybe it was God's will, or maybe I wasn't believing enough, or I wasn't doing this, or I wasn't doing that, and life shouldn't be painful if you do it right. And, I mean, there was a lot of pain coming out of heart surgery, not only the physical pain, but also I had to really contend with the fact that I was in my 20s having a surgery that most people have when they're born, but it was missed. And, you know, there was a lot for me that I had to deal with emotionally. And I got that maybe that is recovery. Like, maybe recovery isn't, you know, how much pain do you not have, or how much do you not feel pain or meditate above it, but really how do you meet it when it happens? And I really had no choice to meet it physically, and I had no choice really to meet it emotionally, but I think, I could have done it in many ways, and I'm really grateful that I had a program to teach me the tools. And a lot of the tenets and a lot of the slogans that I heard here for years and years and years, most of which I didn't understand or didn't really care about, or, you know, whatever. I spent the first bunch of years in program just waiting for my turn to share. And I did that because if I could share and I could make you laugh, then I knew that I was okay. And it gave me an objective place to be on that continuum. If you were laughing, then I wasn't too needy, and I don't know what about self-sufficiency, but thank you, 3 minutes. It gave me some objectivity. If you're laughing with me, not at me, but with me, then I must be okay, and then you must like me, and that's, you know, so many years I just waited for my turn to share. And then over the years I started to really, and especially during recovering from heart surgery, a lot of times where I would go to meetings and I wouldn't necessarily share, but I would just go to be with people and just feel the love and just feel, you know, at the end when we all held hands. It was shortly after my heart surgery where I remember, I don't know if it was a birthday party or a Thanksgiving meeting or something, but I remember having a spiritual experience holding hands, saying the Serenity Prayer at the end of the meeting. And I mean, I don't have much to say about that other than there was just something that I felt like my whole body got warm, and I thought, we're here, joined together. And, so it's powerful. So what do I want to say in my last couple of minutes? I learned a lot about gratitude as I was recovering physically from my heart surgery. And I learned, you know, from day to day, like when I was able to drive after not driving for 6 weeks, or I was able to drive at 4 weeks and to be grateful for that. And then, you know, then when I was able to go back to work part-time, and I was grateful for that because it got me out of myself and away from my apartment with, you know, I don't know, more snacks than I probably needed. But it, just to be grateful for the little things, because the recovery was really slow. And I have to say that, and I guess the thing I'll close with was, it's informed, going through something like that, physically, emotionally, and spiritually, has informed everything that I do now. I mean, you know, not always consciously, thank you in the last minute, but knowing how to survive something like that and be on the other side of that and learn to ask for help and learn to let people in and learn to trust that if people said, we really want to come and visit you and be there for you, that that's really what they meant. And if it wasn't my problem, you know. If you come and be of service to me and you're lying about your motives, that's not my issue. I didn't know that before. And I think it would have looked really differently had I not been in program at the time and had I not been working the steps and not had that as my backbone. Anyway, thank you for letting me share.
Okay, if you would take a moment to stop the Ask It baskets and move them forward, and if Wilma and Jean, my basket helpers, will bring them here to me, please. Okay? When they come forward, just as soon as they come forward. And at this point, please help me welcome Lynn to share her experience, strength, and hope.
I'm Lynn, compulsive overeater. Oh, my God. I came into Overeaters Anonymous in February of 1986. The one thing that I've done perfectly is that I've never left these rooms. And when I came in February of 1986, I weighed 210 pounds. And I got abstinent right away, and I got abstinent right away, and I wanted to take a trip at the 100-pounder meeting in San Fernando Valley, and you had to be a 100-pounder at the time to take chips or to speak or a pitch or anything. So I figured I was 210. 110 was probably a little low for me, so I changed my top weight to 220. And, I mean, when Maxine was telling her story last night, and she kind of did the same thing, it blew me away because I'd never heard anybody else say that. And I changed it to 220, and I was right there not working the first principle of honesty because I didn't tell even my sponsor that I did that. And then they suggest that you don't get into a relationship for a year, so in 6 months I did. And it was a very unhealthy relationship, and it went on for 10 years of breaking up and getting back together and breaking up and getting back together. And I was doing what I did out in the before I came into Overeaters Anonymous. When I came in, we would break up and I'd lose 20 pounds and I'd get a sponsor and I'd work the program, and then we'd get back together and I'd gain 30, and then we would break up, and then I did this until I got up to my top weight of 282 pounds, and I did this still coming to program, sitting in these meetings. Boy, that was really hard. That was really hard, and then. When I wasn't with this person and I was working a program, I learned who my higher power was. I went through the steps in the OA 12 and 12 at the time, and my sponsor at the time suggested I do a WANAD, and that's how I got a relationship with my higher power. I was brought up in a middle-class Jewish household, and my mother told me that if I wasn't the good little girl, God was going to punish me. And I tell this story every time I speak. I was, I don't know, 20 or something. I had a brand new Mustang, and it was the Yom Kippur, and which is when you go to synagogue all day. My family did, and my mother said, "Are you coming?" And I said, "No, I'm staying home." And she said, "You know, Lynn, God's going to punish you." And the next day, I went out to go to work, and my car was sitting on the sidewalk; it had been hit. And I came in, and my mom said, "See." And that's just an example of what I was brought up with my whole life. So getting a relationship with a higher power in this program was very challenging for me. But the years that I was in here not abstaining were not wasted. I was able to find this higher power, get some emotional recovery, but the physical recovery was eluding me. Fast forward about 1999, I surrendered something. I don't know what it was. I got on a good food plan, kept coming back, exercised, lost. That was the first time I lost 100 pounds. Met a person in program. It was after a year, by the way. I did wait. And we fell in love and got married May of 2003, and by that time I'd already put on 80 pounds. I wasn't working this. That was the bottom line. I wasn't working this. Pick up the key of willingness. I felt I was willing, but I didn't take the action of picking up the key. So I got the results I got. We had a very happy marriage. We had a very good relationship. I was just eating. And then, in October of 2005, I started working with somebody who got me in here. They got me in the big book and the doctor's opinion, and I got abstinent. And I went to take my 90-day chip, and I had started losing weight and feeling good, and I came home that day after taking my 90-day chip, and I found out that my husband had passed away. And, on January 7th, 2006. So we just had the 4-year anniversary. And I remember a friend saying, "We've got to keep her abstinent. We've got to keep her abstinent. You know, nobody can keep me abstinent." And when the shock wore off, and, you know, I didn't have that backbone. I kept coming back, but I didn't have that long periods of abstinence, and I certainly wasn't at a normal, healthy body weight. And I don't know about you, but I came in here to lose weight, you know, and I want to be a normal, healthy body weight. So once the shock wore off in March, I was on a business trip in Las Vegas, and I was at a convention where we worked with theater chains, and when you registered, they gave you a goodie bag, and in that goodie bag was concession-sized candy, and it was in my room, and the pain of losing him and my life changing in that split second was so intense, I couldn't take it anymore. And I started eating the candy. And that just started me off again. And for a year and 9 months, I ate. And it was very hard to come to these rooms. He was a abstaining member of this program. He was in the plays every year at the birthday party. And basically when we were married and he was alive and I would come to these rooms, I was coming as his wife. I was not working any kind of program. I was his wife, you know. And I just lost my train of thought. Where was I? Blank. I was his wife. Yes, thank you. Thank you very much. So for a year and 9 months, I kept coming to these rooms. Thank you very much. I kept coming to these rooms, and it was difficult, and I was eating. And pretty soon, I was not eating because he had died. I was eating because I couldn't stop eating. And December of 2007, I was at the recovery from relapse meeting in the Valley, and I went up to somebody, and I said out loud, I can't stop eating. And she is December 23rd, and she said to me, she gave me two assignments. One was to write a list of 10 things of what I forgive my husband for and 10 things of what I forgive myself for. And I have to tell you, that was so healing, and that was the beginning of my recovery. That was, you know, pain hurts, but the recovery was starting to heal me. And I've been abstaining since. And I've taken off 103 pounds. And she had me in here. I went through the AA 12 and 12 with her. I did the inventory in the big book. I go to meetings. I sponsor. I have a sponsor who I don't call very regularly, who's in this room. You know, I live my program today. The 7th, I decided when, you know, the anniversary, that this year I was going to go to work. The other years I took the day off to feel sorry for myself. You know, poor me. And this year I decided that it's time to take that next step to go to work. Didn't mean I didn't love him any less, but I needed to just push my recovery just a little bit further. Today, I'm out in the dating world, and I hate it. Literally today at 1 o'clock, I got an email from my brother that my uncle just passed away. My uncle, here in West L.A., and my father's brother. Now, my dad died of this disease in 1995. He was over 100 pounds overweight, went off to go to work one day, and died of a heart attack. He was 67 years old. Just had one brother who just passed away, and it just started to bring up my dad. You know, I was eating when my dad passed away. I was in these rooms when my dad passed away. And, wow, you know, it. What I know to do today is I had this commitment. I mean, really, pain hurts, recovery heals. Where else should I be knowing that this happened today? And then I will leave here after this and go to my aunt's house for a while just to be with my family, to be of service. And then I'm coming back. Because there's nothing else I can do today, you know? And then I'm coming back here, and I'm going to dance, you know? And I hope to get back for dinner, too, but okay, whatever. This program, you know, when I was eating and sitting in these rooms and people would quote from the big book or say the slogans, I'm like, ooh, you know? But this program gave me a design for living. It really did. Does. As long as I'm willing to pick up that key, you know, and put it in that hole and start working this program. How much time do I have? I thought I'd been talking for him. Oh, my God. You know, I don't know what more to say is, you know, it's just to keep coming back. I'm so glad I did. You know, some days when I'm, you know, because I'm not perfect, but some days I do think, well, you know, I could have gone on the long-timers panel if I had abstained when I walked in here in February of 1986. But you know what? That wasn't my path. And unfortunately, there's a lot of people in these rooms that have the path that I have of, you know, sticking around and eating or leaving and coming back in 20 years and have been eating. And when I did that, 10 things I forgive myself for, that was one of the things I forgave myself for. This is just my path. And, you know, if I hadn't stuck around, I wouldn't be where I am today. Am I happy, joyous, and free today? Actually, there are some days, very few, that I am. I'm still in grief. I'm still grieving the loss of my husband. That's life. But there, you know, before December 23rd, 2006, I had no hope. If my doctor said to me, "You're killing yourself," and I said, "I don't care." I was too chicken to take my life, but if I can eat myself to death, I didn't care. I figured then I'll be with him. You know, that was my reasoning. But if I hadn't stuck around and talked to that person on December 23rd, because I've learned to do that in these rooms. I've learned a lot in these rooms. So all I can say is that if anybody's struggling, just don't leave. Don't leave. And my plan is to be here one day at a time for the rest of my life. There's nowhere else to go. And by the way, I don't care how anybody loses their weight. Get the weight off, because this is where you have to live it. You know, this is your footprint. Is that in the book? I think footprints, blueprint. Blueprint's in the book, right? Your blueprint, you know, to live. And I'm so glad Overeaters Anonymous is here, and I'm very grateful that Roseanne started this 50 years ago and that I'm a part of it. Thank you.
Okay. It is now time for the questions from the Ask It Basket. I'm going to let you know that I combined certain questions because they were very close to one another, and I think we're here for our group recovery. Okay. The first was directed toward Nancy, and the question is, and I combined two, it says, after the coma, what happened with the food, and how did you not go into self-pity?
After the coma, what happened with the food, and how did I... After the coma, what happened with the food, and how did I not go into self-pity? That presumes I didn't go into self-pity. We'll get back to that in a second. But because of the spiritual experience, the profound spiritual nature of my experience, the desire to overeat was absolutely lifted. It was just gone after the coma. And I thought, I mean, and after all, I had brain surgery. I thought maybe I had been cured. I actually thought that because, you know, I didn't... they went in and things were different in there. Thinking wasn't the same. And so for a solid 2 years, I had absolutely no desire to overeat, period. None lifted. But it was not cured. So fast forward, back into real life, back into the steps, back into the program. It wasn't the direct result of the coma, being out of the coma. That was lifted for a couple of years. So that was one of the challenges, was realizing, maybe I'm not cured. You know, 2 years down the line, nobody's thinking about aneurysm every day except me, and the desire is returning. It's like, oh my gosh, how do I manage this? And I had a little bout with anorexia because I wasn't really sure. I was like, then I got afraid to eat. So it was back into the program, back into working the program. And what was the next part about how did I not feel sorry for myself? I did feel sorry for myself. But again, because of the profound nature of it, it didn't. I was so filled with gratitude. It emanated from me. Actually, I kind of glowed for at least a year. It was that profound. So I didn't feel sorry for myself until sometime later. I had a little bout with gallbladder. I had to have emergency gallbladder surgery, and I thought, I didn't know this, but I thought that God had already asked everything of me that He was going to ask, and that I should not be asked to do anything else hard. And so when I suddenly had to have gallbladder surgery and was told, in addition to not having sugar for the rest of your life, now you can't have salt because I've got high blood pressure, got that aneurysm, okay. Now I can't have fat because that's what your gallbladder works on. And I was mad. I was pissed off. So it wasn't that I felt sorry for myself. I was mad that one more thing was being asked of me, and I just had to be patient through it, because that's how it is. That's how it is. I just, and without program, what would I have done? I just would have buried myself in food. So it was just, that was really what I was addressing when I was saying, everything doesn't always come out with like a happy, shiny ending to it. Sometimes that's just, I had to embrace it. I didn't be mad at it, I had to embrace it, because that's how it is. So.
Okay. We're going to kind of combine a few here. It says, I realize pain can be my teacher, but as I have just returned today to OA after many years, happiness can also be my teacher. What do you think? We also have, can you share about seeing pain as an opportunity? And where do you find God in the pain? Okay, these are, you know, give you a feeling for a similar question. Would anybody like to handle that? You're up. Sure. Here you go.
Where do you find God in the pain? That one? All right. Well, you know, for a while I didn't. The pain just overtook everything. It consumed me. I would be in the grocery store and I wanted to tell the checker my husband just died. It's all I thought about. I became a widow. I was no longer a wife, I was now a widow. And I wanted everybody to know it. And there was no, God was not there. I don't blame God for taking my husband. I've learned a lot in these rooms. I believe that was when he was supposed to die, and he got to die happy, a happy person. When I put down the food, I was able to find God again and an unconditionally loving God, the one that I found years ago. I wrote down the word powerless. I didn't know what powerless was until my husband died, because I'm a girl who fixes everything. And I figure if something's going wrong, I could fix my food. I can, you know, not eat this or not eat that, and it only got me into gaining weight. And when he died and I could not bring him back, that's when I learned what powerless was. And I know that God's the only one that can help me with my powerlessness. And I didn't learn that until I finally learned what powerlessness was.
Okay. Please share how you have healed from a breakup. Do you have any suggestions how to work out unresolved grief? What tools did you use? How long did it take?
Okay, so these are all the questions. Okay, heal from a breakup. You know, I think like, healing from a breakup, I usually dump people, so it was a little bit easier. But if you want to know more about that, we can talk in the hall. But not always. How I healed from a breakup was one day at a time, and working the steps and, you know, doing what was right in front of me. And that's not true. I did get dumped once when I was in college, and I thought I had really no experience in relationships other than with my father and a little bit with my mom, but, you know, and then I met this guy, and I thought that now I wasn't going to ever have to be alone again, because I knew that my dad couldn't be with me until I died, and thank God now. But and so when this guy broke up with me, probably because I was smothering the life out of him, which is also another thing that we can talk about in the hall, I don't do that anymore, but I thought that my life was over, and that was one of those things that I shared week after week after week in meetings, and felt bad sharing it week after week in meetings, because some people can just move on from stuff like that. And I just worked the steps and the principles and just did it one day at a time. And someone said every day gets a little bit better, and I had faith in what they said. So let's see, do you have suggestions for how to work out unresolved grief? Well, I think for me, it was like a like a flip happened. And I realized that I don't work out unresolved things. I let them work themselves out while I work the program. And it took so much pressure off my shoulders. There's not a lot that I have to do in terms of my emotions other than feel them, which is actually, I mean, I think that's the tallest order in the whole world. And a friend of mine and I used to say that we think that should be a tool, feeling feelings. So thank you.
Please discuss transitioning from believing that HP is judgmental to believing that God, HP, totally has my back.
Since I was brought up with that punishing God, and then I found this higher power that was unconditionally, unconditionally loving, I had to do a want ad on what I wanted my higher power to be, and one of the things that was so important for me is he had to be big and have long arms so that he can wrap his arms around me because I was so big. And once I got that visualization of what that higher power was, I no longer thought of a punishing God. Now, that doesn't mean that sometimes this comes into my head where, you know, my mother's got a lot of health problems, and sometimes I think, what did she do to deserve this? She did nothing to deserve this. But I want to find blame somewhere, you know, because I don't understand it, and it's about fear. But for the most part, I know that God didn't do that to her. God is giving her strength to walk through her health problems. So for me, the visualization of hugging me is what I use today.
Okay, thank you very much. If you didn't get your question answered here, you may get it answered by one of our speakers outside or from one of each other outside of the room. But please, if you really need to talk with somebody, it's important that you do. These things bring up a lot of feelings and a lot of thoughts. Please help me thank the people who gave service at this particular meeting. Wilma and Janine for being our Ask It Basket monitors. June, who is our timekeeper. And help me thank Lynn, Corey, and Nancy for sharing their experience, strength, and hope. And all of you, if you would, if you care to, please stand where you are, join hands, and join me in the third step prayer. God, I offer myself to thee, to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help, of thy power, thy strength, and thy way in life. May I do thy will always. Amen. Keep coming back. It works. Hi, everyone. A little piece of helpfulness that you could do. If you're not taking your yellow sheet, would you please place them on the back table? Thank you very much.